This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The International Committee of the Red Cross reports some positive signs indicate South Sudan's recent peace agreement is holding and may lead to a sustainable end to years of conflict.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, Angola's new president was voted in as leader of the ruling party over the weekend. We'll find out what changes are in store for the country. Zimbabwe's new finance minister says reviving the country's economy is a massive task. And the head of South Sudan's Civil Aviation Authority says there was reduced visibility when a small plane crashed yesterday morning. We'll have these stories and more all ahead on Africa News Tonight. Well, over the weekend, Angola's President João Lourenço was elected to lead the ruling MPLA party, replacing former President José Eduardo dos Santos. Lourenço has been president for a year, but dos Santos, until Saturday, still led the party. With a resounding 99% of the vote, party members closed dos Santos' 4 decades of control of the country's politics. To explain what the change means to Angola, my colleague João Santarica from the Portuguese to Africa service spoke with me. Thanks for joining me,
and
João.
Thanks for having me here.
Thank you. What does this really mean for the citizens of Angola?
Well, what it means, it's as you said, it's an end of an era, you know, of 40 years. And what everybody is expecting is that there's going to be changes. And the changes have already started on the economic field. In his first year as president of the Republic, João Lourenço, as we know, fired the daughter of the former president from the oil company. He's reformed the oil company to make it only responsible for oil and nothing else. It was a huge conglomerate. He has also called in the International Monetary Fund to discuss a plan to help the Angolan economy, because the previous government didn't want to do that because the IMF wanted to look into the accounts of Angola. So economically, he started to gain the confidence of foreign investors. He started that. There's also been an opening in the media, in the state media. And so now, of course, since he leads the party, everybody expects these changes to accelerate. He's already started that. 25 of the members of the political bureau of the ruling party, which rules the country, basically, were wiped out in this last Congress, and he put in his own people.
Yeah, so what does this mean, or really, what was the final straw that made dos Santos step down on Saturday?
Well, what happened is that dos Santos had promised to leave, but when he left only the presidency of the Republic, and he kept the presidency of the party. Some people say, you know, for him to become like the power behind. This caused a lot of upheaval within the party itself, because many people said that Lourenço could not govern without having the realms of the power of the party under his control. So there was a tremendous pressure for him to leave, and he did.
And what challenges lie ahead now for the new president? What are some of the first things he needs to address?
Well, the challenges are enormous. Angola is a country, very wealthy country, but practically has to import everything. They live off the oil. They have a tremendous amount of debt. Just the other day, the government revealed for the first time, just to China, they owe China more than $21 billion. So they have a tremendous amount of debt. The country economically is in a very, very bad state. So that is his main challenge. At the same time, you are starting to see, for the first time, because of the opening, demonstrations coming up a bit around the country, everywhere, people protesting against the social conditions, unemployment. So one can foresee that this kind of thing is going to increase. So economically, I think, is his main challenge. And politically, he might still have a bit of resistance within the MPLA party, because there are many people who are going to feel threatened by the changes, because they were the beneficiaries of the corruption that went on around the oil business and others. So I think that could be a bit dangerous to him.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. It's my colleague João Santa Rita from the VOA Portuguese to Africa Service. Well, the International Committee of the Red Cross reports some positive signs indicate South Sudan's recent peace agreement is holding and may lead to a sustainable end to years of conflict. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The ICRC Global Director of Operations, Dominique Steelhart, has just returned from a week-long mission to South Sudan. He says the impact of 5 years of war is widespread, palpable, and will not be easily overcome. At the same time, he says there appears to be some reason for hope for improvement in the war-ravaged country. He notes a significant decrease in violence since President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar signed the ceasefire agreement on August 2nd. South Sudan has been plagued by civil war as a result of a power struggle between President Kiir and Machar, his former deputy. Steelhart says it is not surprising to find that people are skeptical about the chance of this accord being implemented, given the many previous agreements which have been broken. But he tells VOA this time may be different, because the deal is strongly supported by Sudan, Uganda, and IGAD, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development.
It is this alignment, which of course is also an alignment based on their individual interests of both Sudan and Uganda, that nevertheless provides perhaps more hope this time that this agreement may be implemented. And yes, I think on the other hand, the leaders also realize that they have to do better.
Steelhart says the people of South Sudan expect their leaders to deliver on that agreement after years of being brutalized by a war that has destroyed their hopes for a viable future. The United Nations estimates that since civil war erupted in 2013, more than 50,000 people have been killed, 2.5 million people have become refugees in neighboring countries, and about 2 million internally are now displaced. Steelhart says it is crucial that the international community does not abandon South Sudan, but continues to help the government live up to the peace agreement. He warns the human cost of continued conflict in South Sudan would be catastrophic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Also in South Sudan, the head of the country's Civil Aviation Authority says there was reduced visibility when a small plane crashed in Ural, Eastern Lake State, yesterday morning. The crash killed 20 passengers and injured 4 others. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba that Captain Subek John with the Civil Aviation Authority says Southwest Aviation chartered the 19-seat plane. John says he was told it was extremely foggy in the area when the plane went down, but it is too early to determine the cause of the crash. John also notes that airlines in South Sudan often overload planes with too many passengers, and the government plans to increase monitoring to enforce regulations. Well, medical workers have lots of experience dealing with Ebola outbreaks in the DRC. The current one is the country's 10th, and they have new tools to fight the deadly virus. A vaccine was used successfully in the last outbreak to prevent Ebola in people who had come in contact with those who had been infected. Now, new treatments are being used to save the lives of Ebola victims. But new and old problems face doctors and nurses. Some people refuse to believe Ebola exists and have hidden infected family members. Traditional burial practices put people at risk. And the outbreak location is in a conflict zone with about 100 armed groups, creating security risks. Caitlin Ryan, a spokesperson for the aid group Doctors Without Borders, spoke with my colleague Paul Alexander about the challenges from Beni, epicenter of the current outbreak.
We've seen that overall there are less patients, but we're seeing patients pop up in new towns. So that means that we've seen a case pop up in Butembo, well, a few cases pop up in Butembo, which is a city of about 1 million. And we've also seen new cases pop up in a town outside Libero, which is another town of about 80,000. So whilst cases are going down overall, we're seeing new cases in other parts of Northern Kivu, which is really quite worrying.
So you have all this new science, you know, a vaccine that was used in the last outbreak and now treatments for those who have actually contracted Ebola. And there's been a pretty big effort to educate people about the virus. But some don't believe that there is a crisis. How frustrating and worrying is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something, the resistance in the community is something that we see in every Ebola epidemic. Ebola is a really scary disease. It's got a survival rate of less than 50%. So the fact that the community starts to resist the response is not unusual. And for us, it's just a sign that we need to do more work in the community. The other thing that's important to note is that whilst it's really great to have these new treatments and to have the vaccination, what's going to end the epidemic is the six pillars. So we need to isolate patients. We need to communicate with the community to explain the disease. We need to do surveillance. We need to do contract tracing. We need to do safe burials. That's what's going to end the epidemic. It's not going to be these new treatments or the vaccine.
So what's it been like trying to fight this in a conflict zone, and how does that complicate things?
So for us, it's meant that we've had to take the decision to not do as many things ourselves as we might in other epidemics. So here we're really focusing on case management, that's dealing with patients and working in the treatment centres, as well as protecting health centres with infection prevention and control. But we've also decided to train ambulance drivers ambulance operators rather than running ambulances ourselves. We've taken a new HP strategy, health promotion strategy, which is really based out of the treatment centres and working through families rather than canvassing the cities and the towns ourselves. So for us, it's meant that we've taken hard choices. For other actors who are implementing the other pillars of the response, it's quite difficult.
You talked about the new patients and how there have been outbreaks outside the core area. The DRC Health Ministry had indicated that it felt that things were under control, but that doesn't sound like what you're describing.
I guess, as far as I understand, the cases that have emerged outside of Mangina and Beni, which were the kind of epicenter of the outbreak, are linked on the epidemiological kind of change. So they're still traced back. I don't think we'll be able to say the entire outbreak is under control until we know where every single case is coming from and we pick them up through contact tracing. It's very difficult to really decide whether an epidemic is under control or not because they're by definition unpredictable.
That was Caitlin Ryan from Doctors Without Borders speaking with VOA's Paul Alexander. Eighteen minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Officials say a car bomb has hit a district headquarters in Somalia's capital, killing at least six people and injuring 16. The blast today targeted the headquarters of Hodan District in Mogadishu. Witnesses said the explosion caused massive destruction to the building. The Al-Shabaab militant group claimed responsibility via its affiliate social media accounts. It is the second time the group has targeted a local district headquarters in Mogadishu this month. On September 2nd, a suicide car bomb destroyed the headquarters of the neighboring Hawadag district, killing three people. Zimbabwe's new finance minister has described his task of reviving the country's economy as extraordinarily difficult, but he is hopeful of success. Columbus Mafunga spoke to Mehuli Nkumbe and reports for VOA.
It's enormous, it's Herculean. I'm very energetic and I'm definitely up to the task. I'm starting now, but in the process, what I'll do is listen.
Zimbabwe's new finance minister, Mutuli Ncube, is a former chief economist and vice president of the African Development Bank. He spoke to VOA at the State House after being sworn into office Monday by President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Nearby, 21-year-old Isaac Majgira is jobless. He dropped out of school 7 years ago after his parents, also unemployed, failed to pay the fees. He now sells cash, which has been in acute short supply for the past 2 years in Zimbabwe. He says he expects change from the new cabinet Mnangagwa put into office Monday.
What we want is corruption to be get rid of, and we want development as quick as possible. I think the issue of money, we need our own currency, which is valued as compared to other currencies than bond notes and Fanauta achieve.
Zimbabwe started printing bond notes about 2 years ago to ease cash shortages. They were supposed to trade at par with the US dollar, but on the black market, the notes are worth about half as much as a dollar, and cash shortages have not ended. Almost as if Ncube spoke to Majgira, the new finance minister said he has to address the current issue for Zimbabwe's economy to get back on track.
Restoring confidence in the economy, making sure that external investors can be interested in Zimbabwe again. I'll be rolling out a plan on the arrears clearance and the whole debt restructuring process. Coupled to that is building credit lines globally, internally, making sure that on the expenditure side, we live within our means or move towards that. We need to strengthen our tax collection systems. Ultimately, we'd like to have a Zimbabwe dollar that is stable, that people have confidence in, because to have a domestic currency, you need to build reserves.
Zimbabwe abandoned its worthless dollar in 2009 and has been using the US dollar, South African rand, and British sterling for trading. An economist for the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe, Prosper Chitambara, says Ncube is a good choice for the job.
It's a good start. He is someone who is credible. He is a professional. But then obviously what then needs to be done is to begin real work, to roll up his sleeves and begin to implement key fiscal policies that will bring back confidence into the economy. Raining down on recurrent fiscal expenditures, for example. In general, what we need are fiscal consolidation reforms that curtail drastically recurrent government expenditures.
He says Zimbabwe's government spends much of its revenue on salaries, leaving social services sectors like education and health in dire need, unless Western aid agencies like the USAID assist. Chitambara says Ncube has to change that if the country is to recover. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Ugandan lawmaker and youth leader Robert Chagulanyi, better known as Bobi Wine, is now in the United States for medical treatment after what he says was torture by Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's security forces. He was arrested in August after a protest during a campaign event for a by-election in the city of Arua. Wine was a pop star and activist before entering parliament in 2017. He continues to compose and perform songs accusing Museveni of corruption and human rights abuses during his 32 years in office. VOA's Adam Phillips takes a look at Wine's popularity in the context of Uganda's political climate.
This is a message to the government expressing what's exactly on the people's mind.
In his video, Freedom, lawmaker Bobi Wine takes aim at Uganda's president, Yoweri Museveni, and his ruling party, with lyrics such as, "We are fed up with those who oppress our lives," and "What used to be a democracy has now become a hypocrisy." Milton Alamadi is a Ugandan-American and the publisher of Black Star News, a New York newspaper for Africans and African-Americans. He believes that song might be the one that made President Museveni's government target Wine.
And then while he's singing and saying that Uganda's now want change, is showing images of the military brutalizing people, people being arrested, people being thrown into trucks, people being clubbed. And then he shows different parts of the country so that he's not only appealing to his home base, but he's actually making a national appeal and sort of a national mobilization. And that hasn't happened before in Uganda.
Helen C. Epstein is the author of Another Fine Mess, America, Uganda, and the War on Terror. She says that music, like wines, often touches people where mere rhetoric cannot.
Music has a way of really sort of reaching people's emotions. People may not always understand the details of every issue, but they can relate to music because it touches a kind of deeper truth inside them. Everybody, even if you talk to people who ostensibly seem to support Museveni inside the country, if you talk to them long enough, they begin to recognize the problems. They all know it, that enough is enough.
Maria Burnett of Human Rights Watch says other factors have also contributed to Wine's success, including the money he made as a pop star before he won a seat in parliament last year.
Uganda runs a pretty significant patronage politics network, and so it's very, very difficult for people to contest for political office if they're not very close to the ruling party. And so, you know, he brings in a very different type of revenue to the political equation, as does the fact that he's of a different ethnic group from the president.
What isn't new, says Burnett, is the government's pattern of obstructing anyone who might threaten Museveni's power.
Over the last several years, opposition parliamentarians and opposition candidates for office have faced significant obstructions as far as campaigning, criminal charges for trying to express divergent views or criticisms of government, in some cases, beatings, arrest, torture. So this is the pattern.
Burnett says journalists who report on human rights abuses also are attacked. And the government has tried to limit social media by shutting down internet access during elections, for example. In May, it imposed a social media tax, infuriating many people.
The social media tax is a way to make it harder for people with less financial resource to participate in free expression.
Museveni still has millions of supporters who say he's stabilized the country. But nearly three-quarters of the population is under the age of 35, and many are looking for a younger generation of leaders. The government denies harming its opponents or using torture. It rejects Wine's allegation that he was tortured after being arrested last month when a protest broke out during a campaign event. Police say he was injured while fighting officers who tried to arrest him. For now, Bobby Wine is pursuing treatment in the U.S., although he says he plans to return home to Uganda for his next court date at the end of the month. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
I'm Lenore Moudou, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we will take a look at the ongoing Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Our guest is Dr. Malonga Myatudila, senior public health specialist and one of the doctors who first discovered the Ebola virus in the DRC in 1976. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a discussion with Ugandan pop star Bobby Wine on his arrest, detention and release. and why he came to the U.S. to seek medical attention. Ugandan politics in the spotlight on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.